This man, this particular person here, was the water or cloud of heaven. This seemingly represented a sieve. The name of the little basket sieve used to sift grain. These were serpent symbols. These were the persons who traveled. This particular person carried an infant. Now they started out, and they went through all the adventures which came in the creation of their journey and their final establishment in the Valley of Mexico. The point that interests us, we can't go begin to go through the whole story. It would be rather meaningless after a certain point because it settles into wars and griefs and troubles. But here is one of the earliest and most traditional forms of the origin of these people. That they came from a land or an island that is gone. That on this island there were seven temples or seven sacred places. This was where their Adam and Eve were placed, where they just came from. And here they traveled by boat to another land and began to move across that land. Where they moved and how they moved, we cannot know unless we could find out the point where they struck land. If we knew the landfall of this expedition, we would know what to do next, but we do not know. We do not know what they meant by this community. We do not know where it is. We know that in the time or the day of the one flint knife, that they made this particular journey and started out on this travel, coming by water from somewhere. Now these particular glyphs, and there are more similar picture manuscripts, some even resembling more closely islands than this does. These have all led to considerable comfort to those who feel that this people definitely did come as they themselves believed they came from some island or continent now submerged and lost. Now we want to pause again and take up the problem of the people that we call the Mayas further south, because we're going to have to also visit them again. But for that purpose, let us realize that the word Maya simply means greetings. How are you? And when the Spaniards first arrived in the area, the Indians met them and, bowing very low, said Maya. From that time on, they were Mayans. Actually, the name has no actual or real significance in the ethnology of this group of people. The real name of these people, as far as we know, is the Itzas. And the Itza gained his name or his distinction because he was the child of Itzamna. And Itzamna is the radiant being seated in the golden egg of heaven, adorned with the plumes of the bird of paradise. He is the mysterious father of the peoples, referred to sometimes as the ancient one with the crooked tooth. According to the early legends, Itzamna was a patriarch, a very great and wonderful man, and there was a great catastrophe far away across the great water. And Itzamna took a remnant of that people and put them in boats. And he navigated with them, and he carried them, or he guided them across the water, presumably pausing somewhere in the West Indies and then continuing on to the coast of Mexico or Central America. Where Itzamna originally landed, we do not know. There are several contenders for the distinction of having solved this riddle, but the riddle is not actually solved. Some believe that it was probably in the area of Palenque in southern Mexico. Others believe that it was more likely still further south, either in the peninsula of Yucatan or even south of that. But anyway, he came across from somewhere and was called the father of the Itzas. He was their great god, for he had rescued them from the dangers of Hunabku, the god of waters. And he had saved them and preserved them from the deluge. And in some of their old temples, there are actual carvings representing this. Carvings which go so far as to show the land from which he came crumbling into the sea as the result of seismic cataclysms of some kind. People are drowning in the water around the boats, but Zamna and his chosen people were carried safely across the great deluge and came finally to the shores of the Western Hemisphere. We have no way of dating this, except the possible speculation. We do not have any record in the Western Hemisphere of the older and opening cycles of the Maya calendar. It begins in the seventh cycle on the Western Hemisphere, so far as we know, even in the old empire. Therefore, the other six cycles may relate to the experiences of these peoples in some other region. The attitude that these were purely mythological cycles, as advanced by Spinden, I do not think is a justifiable one. We mention the fact that of the ancient Maya writings, only three are known to exist today that are in common agreement, that experts agree are absolutely genuine. These are the Codex Dresden, which is in Dresden at the present time. The second is the Codex Pires, very fragmentary, which is in the Bibliothèque Nationale in France. And the other is now in two sections, but they were originally one book, called the Troano and the Cortesiano, or more correctly, the Tro-Cortesiano, which is in Madrid. These represent our knowledge of the ancient literature of the Maya people. In the same unusual service for the Mexican Bureau of Archaeology and Ethnology, these manuscripts have also been reproduced in Mexico, in this particular case, also 25 copies were made. Manuscript of the Picture Ritual of the Maya, conserved in the Library of Dresden in Germany. These copies were made in 1947. This shows you almost instantly, in comparison to the last one, the difference in the culture platform and the written forms of these people. Here you have manuscripts in a comparatively high degree of written form. You're no longer dealing merely with pictoglyphic and pictographic representations. You are dealing with illustrated manuscripts, as we have noted, the panels representing certain deities, the intervening sections representing dates, times, historical incidents, and ritualistic material. Most of these manuscripts belong to a class that is known as the Tonalámatl, which simply means calendar. They were books relating to the motions of the heavens, sacred days, the ceremonies of the various gods, and other attendant religious details. But apparently a number of them did drift along into history, and like your Chinese almanac, which is a good parallel for it, included fragments of information on all useful and useless subjects that came to mind at the moment. This, however, is interesting to us primarily because leaf 74 of the manuscript Dresden, that is the leaf here, the dark leaf with the elaborate illustration, is the leaf hit upon by both de Bourbourg and Laplongeon, and substantiated very strongly by Lewis Spence of the British Museum and other modern Americanists as being the representation of the deluge. This is believed to be the Maya glyphic representation of the sinking of Atlantis. Now, perhaps you may have a little difficulty in recognizing it right off, but I will try to be a little bit helpful. Laplongeon claimed that he had been able to decode this panel of text and these characters here. But apart entirely from the decoding, we have certain indications. Here is the sky dragon, or sky serpent, the same one that appears on the calendar stone in Mexico. This is the great Coatl, the serpent. On the back, in the form of the scales, are constellational symbols used to represent star groups, planets, and sidereal phenomena. They are trying to tell us here that something happened under this combination of planets or signs of the heavens. And they have inscribed it, as the Aztecs did later, upon the coils of the serpent of heaven. You will notice that out of the mouth of the great serpent there pours a stream of water. This is the Maya water symbol. A great stream of water is pouring out. In other words, the sky or heavens have opened and dumped a deluge or a mass of water. Great storm would be the least you could say for it. Now, in addition to being a great storm in this case, we have a strange figure here. You see, this storm of water is coming not only from the mouth of the dragon or serpent, but also coming from certain of the constellational symbols on its body. There's a great flowing downward. This blue with dots in it is water. Here also we find a strange person that Laplanjon and others believe represented the Earth Mother. And she also has a bucket or bowl of water overturned, which is continually pouring more water. In other words, the water is flowing from everywhere, downward onto this, into this sea. Below is another figure, the god of death. He is arrayed in his proper and typical form, and he is dancing upon the earth. He carries in his hand the great ceremonial atlatls and the throwing stick, the sign similar to the thunderbolts of Zeus in meaning, the symbols of his weapons and adornment. He is painted black to symbolize death. Therefore, the heavens open, the Earth Mother's fountains have been loosened, and death dances upon the earth. And in comparison to their usual use of symbolism, this heroic representation, because they have many lesser symbols of storms and things of that nature, and coming as it does at the close of a cycle, as represented by the manuscript, nearly all persons interested in the Atlantic theory have come to the conclusion that this was their effort to represent the universal deluge. And that from this point on, you have an entirely new way of life represented in the adventures and migrations of these people. Now, actually, no one knows with certainty whether this manuscript should be read in this way, with this as the end, or whether it should read from this end, which, of course, incidentally, this title page is not part of the manuscript. That is the editor's edition. It begins here. Now, if by any chance this manuscript should be read by the Chinese method, then you would begin at the back rather than the front. And then you would have the whole story unfolding after the deluge, whatever it may be. So if it is according to the old Eastern way of writing, then the manuscript would read on from this point, perhaps tying again with the idea of the beginning of the calendar system on the other little manuscript, which began with the one flint knife. This might well be to say that an ancient world passed away, and now we begin the chronicle of those who survived and what they did. We find representations of Itzamna in these manuscripts as the father of his people and as the one who preserved his nations from the destruction at the time of the Atlantic catastrophe. Now, further research into this problem takes us into another related area. And that related area is the Kichi culture, which is a stem of the Maya and lies between the Maya and the Aztec culture geographically in the Mexican region. The Kichis worship the deity Quetzalcoatl in the form of Gucumatz, another term for the feathered serpent. And they had a mystery or a ritual which they celebrated and which has been preserved for us in a rather imperfect but perhaps significant copy. This copy is regarded as imperfect because it was undoubtedly compiled after the introduction of Christianity into the area. Therefore, to what degree it represents a mixture of old beliefs and new beliefs, we do not actually know. And we must, therefore, be a little conservative, for the person who wrote the manuscript to which we refer could have had access to the Genesis account in the Bible. Thus, we are not sure what our ground is in this particular case. The work to which we refer is the Popol Vuh, which is the sacred book of the Kichi, a very good edition having been prepared and published by Dr. Morley shortly before his death. In fact, I think part of the publication work was finished after his death. He did a great deal with this, for it contained the initiation ritual of a religion which may well be a key or clue to the spiritual convictions of the peoples of the Western Hemisphere prior to the advent of the Spanish. But as we say, there is a reservation here due to the dating of the only available copies of the manuscript itself. But in this, there is certainly Indian traditional involvement. And in this involvement, we have one interesting thing, which is apparently authentic because it is perfectly consistent with practice all over the world. We know in the great Midi Lodge of the Ojibwe Indians, the candidate into initiation into the sacred rites is forced to walk. Remember the footprints. He is forced to wander, to make a certain peregrination through the symbolic recapitulation of the life of his people. He must, in other words, relive symbolically the story of his race in the process of attaining membership in the tribe. The story of the Popol Vuh carries with it the adventures of these young men seeking to be initiated into the rites of Shabalba in a temple hidden far in the jungle. A temple which, when reached, had its important rooms and crypts under the ground, so that the candidates had to return into the serpent's hole or go back under the earth, with perhaps again reference to the Navajos having come out from there and believing it was their homeland and going back again. On their way into the mysteries, however, at the rites of Shabalba, the candidate was forced to swim across two rivers, a river of blood and a river of mud. Now, this could have a great deal of significance. By the river of blood would be certainly implied the blood record, the blood tradition, the blood background of his people, and by the river of blood also war. And to these people, because the Mayas were themselves a peace-loving people, the introduction of a river of blood at the beginning of their life must certainly have had reference to war, to disaster, to catastrophe of some kind, with a great bloodshedding, a great evil. To them, blood was a symbol of evil. To swim across a river of thin mud or watery mud might well be a recapitulation of their trip from another land across water to reach their present abode. In other words, before the young man could enter the ancient sanctuary, he had to journey across blood and water. Now we have sacraments of blood and water. We have the Eucharist, which can and perhaps does have a totally different significance. But does it? Is there a possibility that Eucharistic rites, as we know they were practiced in pre-Christian times and by non-Christian peoples, also have something to do with gratitude for salvation from death and destruction? We have these rituals among the most primitive aboriginal peoples. Therefore, it is possible that they relate back to the effort to preserve a record. In the Inca culture, much further south in Peru, we come upon an entirely different situation. The Incas were not a people. They were a race of or order of rulers. They were a hierarchy that imposed themselves upon a pre-Inca people that existed in the highlands of the Andes long before the rise of the Inca dynasty. For the Incas themselves, we have a very reasonable story. We know that they probably came from Asia, that perhaps they brought with them a fairly extensive knowledge of organization and government and things of that nature. And as we have, I think, mentioned on other occasions, the Japanese have a tradition that this dynasty was founded by Japanese who had been driven off their courses by storms and had never been able to return home. This is quite possible, and perhaps explains why the Japanese government presented a statue of the first emperor of the Incas, Mango Capac, to the Peruvian government, stating that this man was Japanese. In any event, the Inca culture does not present any unusual problems. It flourished for a comparatively short time, it was a highly advanced culture, and it was completely disrupted and destroyed by internal dissension even before the arrival of Pizarro. Therefore, the Spaniards gave the last blow to it, but it was in a dying state even then. Prior to this, however, there was a very ancient people in that region, a people of great attainment, of very old religious background. These people, the pre-Incas, also claim that at one time, long before, they had possessed a written language. Now, this is interesting because whatever happened in connection with Mango Capac, even though he came comparatively late, he did not bring a written language. These people claim to have had one, and their ancient records say that this language was lost thousands of years ago. Lost so far back that there were not even any inscriptions of it that survived. But it is interesting that an illiterate people should have the boasted memory of literacy and have it before they had any idea that it meant anything, was important, or even existed. You take a typical and complete savage who has had no contact with civilization. He not only has no written language, but he cannot conceive of the existence of one. It has no meaning for him. But here is a people that before the coming of the Incas were weeping for the loss of their written language. Countless records of this will be found among their early documents. Out of what was ever was left of this, came the pre-Inca means of communication in Peru. And this was by means of what are called the quipas. Now, the quipas are fringes of knotted cords. And the knots on the cords form a kind of code. And those who are acquainted with certain combinations of knots can read them. And in this way, messages can be sent back and forth. The memory, apparently, is like the Chinese, completely arbitrary. There is no alphabet behind it. There is no organization of how these knots should be tied. But certain patterns of them are known to stand for certain things. And as a result of that, there was this method of communication. Out of the same darkness and elderness of things, these pre-Incas in South America also had great and important legends. They should be included among those who believed that at the dawn of time the gods walked with men. They had hero myths and hero legends that went way back to the time when they had writing. And they declared that at a long remote time gone, they were a great, flourishing, advanced, civilized people. And yet when the Incas arrived, these were little better than aborigines. But they were strangely proud aborigines, strangely aware of their rights and privileges. Now the Incas did extend their power pretty thoroughly throughout the Peruvian region. But in the higher fastnesses of the Andes, the so-called tribal life of the pre-Inca not only survived the rather brief dynasty of Inca rulers, but also survived the Spaniards. The reason for the survival of the Spaniards, surviving the Spaniards, was the Spaniards never got there. And the trails were too distant. The Spaniards tried to get into the area looking for the so-called lost treasures of the Incas. In some cases, the report is circulated about these Incas having taken their gold and their treasures into mountains, and there to have caused the whole mountain to fall over the entrance of the cave, bearing not only the treasures, but the last rulers of the Incas themselves. All kinds of legends abound. But although the Spaniards did their best, they never found the treasures, and they never got into the distant and remote parts of the empire. Incidentally also, the empire of the Incas was a highly useful, highly moral culture. And even the dynasty of the Incas, which was a later part of this culture, was highly advanced. So much so, in fact, that when Pizarro asked the Inca what they did with criminals in Peru, the Inca said he did not know because they never had any, which was a little embarrassing to the Spaniards. The Incas did not believe in war. They converted their enemies instead of killing them. They took undesirable citizens, put them in outlying districts, gave them farms, and helped them to rehabilitate themselves. They believed that crime was sickness and that the man should be made well rather than punished. And they taught that even before the coming of the Incas. Also, we find that far behind this entire pattern is what might be termed by us the highly communized life of the Inca villages, the communal existence which these people still practice. They still have extraordinary functioning democracy. The highest democracy in the Western world was that of the Incas. They also had a highly developed code for the protection of all classes of their peoples. They were almost without crime. Their religions were brilliant and liberal and tolerant. They did not oppress their peoples, but like the Mayas, lived for the most part in a highly noble condition. In fact, it has been observed by Stuart Chase that in the first 5 centuries of the Christian era, the peoples of the Western Hemisphere were without doubt the most highly civilized persons on earth. Also, that they held in the Western Hemisphere the world's record for peace, 500 years without war. A record the Eastern Hemisphere and Europe never attained. So these people also show from their beginnings that they participated in a high concept of government. The Maya shared in this. The Aztecs, who were a younger and more warlike people, were beginning to grow into the maturity of their contact with the Maya world to the south of them. The Aztec was moving forward rapidly, but he was certainly a younger and more aggressive culture without nearly as much psychic growth, as much maturity emotionally and mentally as the tribes further south. But in any event, at the time of the arrival of the Spaniards, the Maya Empire was without question a model of a kind of government which has great interest to us. It is interesting for us to speculate upon the possibility that this land, which we hold so sacredly as a democratic commonwealth, may well have been the seat of the first functioning democracy in the history of the world. The democracy may in some way be strangely bound to this hemisphere, in its experience, in its psychic way of life. We find the tremendous sense of democratic integrity, even among the wild plains Indians of our Northern America. We find it more and more developing as we go further south. We find the voice of the people. We find representation, good laws, good rules, and practical absence of the exploitation and bondage of peoples that we find in other parts of the world. We find wonderful rules and laws governing behavior and conduct and protecting people and protecting their rights and protecting them even from their rulers at a time when Europe had no such rules of any kind. Now, it is quite possible that these rules, these laws, these political theories, which are so in advance of that known in Europe, but were preserved from time immemorial, said to have been brought to this western land by the great teachers that came from the sea, like Quetzalcoatl, that this might have had something to do with the nature of the political structure of the old Atlantean Empire. It is quite possible that this empire, like the one in Peru and the Maya Empire, and in a small and less adequate way, the Aztec Empire, that all of these were empire democracies, like the empire democracy of Venice. That they did have monarchical leadership, but that, as in the case of Mexico, their royalty was not hereditary. The individual was elected for life, but he was not born into office. Every step of the way was under very definite rights of the people to have a say in the government of their land. Perhaps there is nothing more interesting also in the entire concept that we find in the Western group than this concept of the bundling up of years, something with which they apparently had come again into contact with Chinese ideas, for the root of the idea, at least, can be traceable in China. And that is that every so many years, various times, usually about 50 to 56 years, often 52 years, that in these periods, which constituted the time of the reconciliation of the Sun-Venus calendar, that these peoples created a jubilee. Kingsborough points this up as a possible tie with the Near East. At this time, a series of rituals took place. And of course, this immediate success of Cortes was due to the fact that he arrived on the Western Hemisphere, in the Western Hemisphere, on the exact date of this 52-year cycle. Therefore, this was regarded as a peculiar and sacred omen. But in this cycle, we have a series of very interesting points. First, it was their way of breaking up all pattern of debt. Also, their way of permitting accumulation to be so reintegrated or reorganized that it would be impossible for a situation to build up that would go on indefinitely and finally sink an economic system. They had these stop gaps on their policies. For instance, at the time of this cycle, all persons had to forgive debt. That was a sacred duty, because this cycle was sacred to the memory of their deity Quetzalcoatl, to whom they were all dedicated. And it was his wish, left ages before, that every so many years, all debt within the state should be wiped out, so that it could never pyramid, so that debt could never descend from generation to generation. Also, at that time, all reasonable bills, all normal bills, had to be paid. A man could not voluntarily owe anything. But if, by circumstances, it was impossible for him to pay, or if he was dead and his children would have to carry the burden, or the widow in pain would no longer have a livelihood, these were all wiped out. But as a sign of his own integrity, each man voluntarily tried to meet this day with clean hands. The second thing that he had to do was to forgive all enemies. He could carry no animosity or enmity, private or political, past the sacred day. If there was any person he had not spoken to or against whom he held a grudge, he must solve it. And the person against whom he held the animosity, or who held animosity against him, must forgive him. Not to do this was a sacred crime, punishable by mortal punishment. In other words, it was a crime against God, punishable by man. And any person who could prove that his enemy had not forgiven him could take his enemy to court and cause this enemy to be heavily penalized. And if the enemy flatly refused to forgive the crime or forgive the affront or injury, whatever it might be, real or imaginary, he could be executed. No grudge could live through that day, because this was the day of the God. And it was believed by these people that on one of these sacred days, Quetzalcoatl would return. And the day he came back, he must come back to a land in which there was nothing but peace and virtue, because that was what he had left. And that is what the ancient ones, the forefathers of the present tribes, had promised would be the way it was when he came back. Therefore, he came back not to cleanse the sinner, but to come back to a world in which the sinners had cleansed themselves in his name. A very interesting and, I think, a very powerful thought. He did not come back to require forgiveness. He came back because forgiveness had been attained. These things were right. Then, like the ancient peoples of other nations, all fires were extinguished, because it was necessary that a new light should be given to the world. And with the dawn of the first day of the new cycle, with the rising of the sun, the promise of the continuance of the world was celebrated. For it was assumed as a sacred fact that it would continue through the next bundle of the years. Therefore, the new light was lit. The new clothing was put on. The new painting was done to the house. Everything was made new and clean. Every person had to be immaculate in cleanliness. No action that was unclean could be performed. This was a period of fasting, a period of ceremonial ritual, a period in which all good things were done and given, and the people were brought back again into peace and harmony. Also, all grudges between nations or tribes within the state had also to be reconciled. There could be no more rumors of war. There could be no more underhandedness. No spies or saboteurs could remain. And so strong and complete was the belief of these people that it was not violated. And one of the amazing things is that it was rare indeed that any one of them ever had to be punished. This was part of their code, that they should meet the new years, the new order of life, each 52 years, with a brand new clean world, in which everything that would hurt or hinder or retard was gone. Now, these ideas did not originate, I do not think, with these people. They say that they did not. They tell us that this law was given to them by the seaman. And it's quite possible that we could open, by reflection and study, a strong case by which perhaps we could restore the judicial code of the common source or center of our cultures, a code which spread throughout the world with various modifications and ramifications, but in the course of time was generally corrupted. But in some of these outlying regions where people remain very close to the old ways, perhaps the code was kept more completely, more intensely than it is to be found in other nations. If we did have, as Plato assures us there was, a great legislative or judiciary system in Atlantis, a rule by good laws, it is very possible that these laws became the basic tribal laws, which have always been strangely honored by wise people because of their extraordinary integrity. The same thing is true of the great laws of the League of the Five, later Six Nations, the Great League of the Iroquois Peoples. It has been said that it was said in Oxford University years ago that the Code of the Iroquois is the highest moral ethical code known to man, higher than the Code Justinian or the Code of Hammurabi. The most exalted pattern of human conduct ever devised, and the wise ones at Oxford pointed out that it was given to us by a group of men wrapped in the skins of animals, sitting under a tree with a feather in their hair. Yet the wisdom of this code, the tremendous integrity of it, transcends us. And Woodrow Wilson, in creating his League of Nations, which was built upon the League of the Iroquois Nation formula, used or incorporated into his points many of the essential elements of the Code Iroquois. This code also has this strange respect and veneration for the inevitable and immutable rights of men. It created a senate. The senators were called sachems. These senators were just exactly as representative of their people as any senator that we have, perhaps more so than most. There was one difference, however, in the League Iroquois. No sachem or senator could become in any way involved in a legislation relating to the province he represented. He could never vote for anything in which he had personal interest. Others had to vote for that. The second thing that was very interesting about him is that in the days of his tribal legislation, he was elected to office. By what? By the vote of the women. Why? Because the Iroquois nation was a nation of brood families. And in all brood families, the matriarch is the head of the family. She did not hold office, but she appointed the office holder, and he was responsible to her. Now, that is, I think, very interesting, back before Columbus, in this poor, wretched Western world of savages. Another interesting and wonderful thing was the Great League Belt, which was the symbol of the League. The man carrying this League Belt could go through any territory within the domains of the red man. And that belt was honored. Nothing could be done to it. A League Belt of this quality was presented to William Penn as a sign by these Indians that they regarded him as worthy. And the symbol of the League Belt was five men holding hands, the five nations. And the order of the League was, the great concept of the League was, all men under one roof. That one sky was over all men, that all men were brothers, that all men were equal before God, and that in this equality it was the privilege of each man to protect the others, and no man should protect himself. Because if this was mutually fulfilled, others would be there to protect him. This concept was a great concept and a very old one. It did not begin with Daganoweda, the founder of the League. He received it, in turn, from a mysterious being who came down on a cloud from a mysterious land beyond. He received it as having come from the Olds, from the great ones who were the guardians of his people. He received it as coming from the most ancient times, long before the rise of the red man on the Western Hemisphere. The Code Iroquois could not have come from Hammurabi. It is a different code. It could not have come from any known code that we have today, because there is no ancient code of primitive origin today that compares to it in any way. Therefore, if it came down from the Olds, it came down from some way that we do not know or understand. It came from some place which is forgotten. Now, we might also bear in mind one other important tradition which links the Eastern Hemisphere with the Western and may very well also arise from your Atlantic complex. and that is the descent of what has sometimes been called natural magic. All primitive peoples share in mysterious powers which are lost to sophisticated peoples. They possess an instinctive hypersensitivity, if you wish to call it. Their religions and their rites have always been associated with magic. Plato tells us, and other ancient records affirm the same, that the secrets of transcendental magic were first disseminated from Atlantis. That here was the land of the old magic, the old arts, the necromantic arts, the arts of wizardry and witchcraft, the arts of demonology, which ultimately destroyed the island. Natural magic, however, whether it be good or ill, whether it be the sensitivity of the psychic or the medium, this tradition of the secrets of magic descending through certain orders of priests, of ancient ones, who received this tradition from time immemorial and accepted candidates into these practices only as the results of tests and initiations, this structure exists on the Western Hemisphere just as much as it existed in the Mediterranean region or in Asia. Therefore, these rites, these rituals, also have to have come from some common source. The great medicine lodge of the Ojibwe, the Midi ceremonials, are as complete a ritual of initiation as anything we find in Egypt, and almost identical. The candidate advances from the west to the east. He passes through certain rites and rituals. He is tried and tested. He passes through a ceremonial, significant, symbolical death and resurrection. And he performed these ancient rites long before there was any known contact between Europe and America. These things, as Lapongeon and others have pointed out, seem to tell us beyond any reasonable doubt that at the root of time there was also the symbolic and significant belief that by certain disciplines and secret procedures, and the American Indian has his equivalent of yoga, that secret sciences and rites were possible. And just as surely as the East Indian fakir grows the mango tree, so your medicine priest in the Southwest grows his magical corn in a half an hour. These rites were witnessed and described by the late Mr. Lummis, who was quite a character both in those parts and in these parts years ago. All of these stories seem to show us, again, another continuity, dim, the kind of continuity old Hosteen Klaas seemed to remember, the remembrance of old times and great things, the memory of a learning half forgotten, the memory of lands vanished, the memory of peoples who came out of the earth, maybe over the horizon, who knows, or out of lands submerged by mud and darkness. But always these people coming out of great danger, establishing themselves and building a world, this world not as great or not as glorious as what they had known, but gradually perhaps attempting, as the Mayas did, to climb back over this pyramid of the past and reconstruct it. The great patterns of the Mayan cities, their architecture, their art, their astronomy, their music, these things are not simply derived from neighboring peoples. They came from something deeper and richer. There is a great architecture in Central America. It is as great as anything we have in Egypt, but it is not the same. Where did it come from? It did not come from those Indians we know today. It came, as they themselves believed, from records, from traditions, from the ancient help of their founding father, Itzamna, who brought them there, who had the knowledge, who helped them to restore their ancient rites. And then they were received, they received help through the descent of these Quetzalcoatls, of which there certainly was more than one. Mysterious feathered serpents, an order of priests or teachers. The first one remote, probably Atlantean. The others arising perhaps in intermediate areas, but bringing to them knowledge, great knowledge. And finally, as in the case of Quetzalcoatl, being driven back into the sea again by the Aztec god of fire, Tezcatlipoco. These legends will sometime have to unravel a great scientific knowledge which we have not today. These people knew the stars. They knew geometry. They were advanced in medicine. The Incas performed excellent trepanning on the brain, and the patient recovered. There, the Incas and Mayas both inlaid teeth with precious stones and did excellent dentures. These people were not savages. But when you ask them how they knew what they knew, how they had managed to preserve these skills, they can't tell you. They can only say that this we were told. This knowledge came from our fathers who possessed it. Who knew these things? We do not know them. The great ones of long ago knew them. And we are their children. And we have received these monuments as a heritage. We do not even know who built them. But they were built by the gods. They were built by the great ones who walked the earth in the dawn of time. These are their monuments. Therefore, we know they were here. These are their footprints, so we shall not deny that they have passed this way. We do not know who this Quetzalcoatl is, that accompanied by a singing band of craftsmen marched from the land of the seven colors. We do not know how it is that he taught us to work precious metals and precious stones and make images for our gods and adornments for ourselves, and how he set up great craftsmen, and how he created a wonderful school of craftsmen at Cholula. And here they taught all kinds of knowledge, of building, of architecture, of agriculture, of science, of medicine, of music. All these things were taught by these great ones, who then, singing and chanting together, walked away again, walked off into the sea, and were never seen again. These legends from so many places cannot all be fabrications. They cannot all be merely imaginings. Nor can a handful of modern enthusiasts be said to have invented them. They did not. Perhaps in some cases the modern enthusiast has exaggerated what the information was that he had to work upon, but he did not invent it. Because each in turn refers to his sources, and these sources are valid. And these sources seem to tell us, beyond any question of doubt, that sometime in the past, that a structural system, a cultural system, such as that referred to by Plato, most certainly could have existed, probably did exist, and that from it has descended the scattered remnants of isolated cultures that we know today. That sometime we will put the pieces together again, for what nature has broken apart, nature will again unite. And in the course of our scientific searches through the centuries ahead, we will ultimately uncover the evidence to tell how this cultural motion existed, where it came from, and who was behind it. But until some better explanation or more adequate formula is found, we may consider with thoughtfulness and with care, not with quick acceptance, not with gullibility, but with thoughtfulness, the fact that there is a strong, reasonable case for the existence of a great culture that disappeared from the world 12,000 years before the Trojan War. If we place that culture where they believed it to be, we can then put all these parts together and have a structure that is meaningful. And until some better solution is found, I think we are entitled to view this with some favor as a probability. Now, I think our time is up as usual, so we've covered as much ground as we could.